So I think what we're very curious about, if you can talk a little bit about what your decision to go into missions as medical professionals. I think that's what Michelle also really wants to hear. It might be from, I don't know, it might be from way back at the Ethiopian.
All right, so I can say that I was a slow developer. So in school, I did very badly in school. I wasn't interested. But something happened to me when I came to Australia. Something happened and I started studying. And I don't think I did well enough to get into medicine, but I did. And then I said, Lord, you know, I'll give back to you this thing and be a medical missionary. So that was from when I first entered medical school. And so I met different missionaries along the way that encouraged me. So one was Barry Hicks in this house group. He connected me with a surgeon from Singapore who worked in Niger called Andrew Ng. He's legendary. He's just
Singapore.
Passed away. Yeah.
Oh,
from Bat
SGH.
Bishop.
SIH.
SIH.
Huh?
He was working in SGH, right?
Well, a long time ago. He's in his 70s. He was in his 70s.
When he left, he was in his 30s to Africa.
Yeah. So I corresponded with him and then eventually went to Niger for my elective in 1981. I had quite a few questions to be answered, like, you know, how can I bring my family up in Africa with all this? And to see him with his two kids there thriving. And then the Lord spoke to me from Genesis 12. Says, leave your country and your household and I will bless you and your descendants, right? Mm-hmm. So what the Lord said is, if Abraham hadn't gone, then his children would have missed out on the blessing. I thought, oh. So that was quite revolutionary for me to think that way. Yeah. And after that, I was quite happy to really go out and believe that if God calls you, he will bless you. Even though Abraham had to go to a place he had never seen, never been. It's like Africa was like, you know, so far away, so many unknowns, so unsafe, and all those sort of things. And that was back in the 80s. So it was there, I got interested in surgery, came back here. He was wanting me to go back straight away so that he could train me to be a surgeon, but most of my bosses said, no, don't do that. Train as a surgeon here, and then you can go, because when you come back here, you're not recognized. So I think that was very good advice. So got married and then got trained in surgery, and after that we left. So that's in a nutshell. But interestingly, we're reflecting on how the life of missionaries have influenced us more than we know. So my great-grandfather, now you're talking about way back, my great-grandfather on my mother's side migrated from China to Perak, and he was a tin miner, sent my grandfather to ACS, and my great-grandfather passed away. So my grandfather told the headmaster, Mr. Hawley, he says, I can't afford to come anymore. So the headmaster was a missionary. ACS was, I think, run by the Methodists.
Yeah, Methodists.
Yeah. So it gave my grandfather a scholarship. And then he became, he started attending the Methodist church, sent my mum to the Methodist college. And so, you know, had not been for Mr. Hawley, then my grandpa, you know, and subsequently. So I just stand back and think, wow, these are unseen influences of missionary life on me and my family. And I guess you sort of complete the circle by going back. So yeah, that's how. And as well as the Brethren Church was, you know, missionaries that came out. The Methodists actually had a big impact in Singapore, I think, and then Malaysia. And the Brethren as well, they set up schools. And churches. So as in latter years, after having been to Africa, all this sort of history came back, and it's just amazing to see the mosaic. You know, we just fit in a little bit in the big picture.
What would you say to medical students, like, I mean, I guess there are so many decisions that face, you know.
I think the scope of service is not mission work. I think you, right, it's who you are and how you treat every individual is important. And I think the place is not important. You can treat people here, you can treat people in Ethiopia, you can treat people in London. But if you, you need to treat them as a Christian, treat, respect the person that you, you treat. And that speaks, that to me is missional, right? Because I think people put missionary work on a pedestal, missionaries on a pedestal. I think that's so wrong. Because ministry is not missionary work. Ministry is who you are, what God has given you to do, and do what God has put in your hands to the best of your ability, with His strength, with His glory. And train to be the best you can be. Because I think that's one of the biggest impact you can make, is be well trained. It's terrible if you're an incompetent medico and trying to preach, you know, and that's really a bad testimony if you're giving bad treatment to people. So I would encourage you to do that and seek higher training. Training, it's always useful. And it's, if you think of overseas work, they will open doors. Now they say, oh, doctor, not enough, right? They want you to be like something else. Because now developing countries are become developed, so what was good 50 years ago doesn't apply now. And find a life partner that will support you. I think that is so important. That's true. You need a partner that has the same vision. Otherwise, it's very difficult.
How about you? So, how was your?
Oh, I think when I became a Christian, I was into Christian literature. I was reading a lot of Isabel Kuhn's OMF books, you know, Isabel Kuhn, J.O. Fraser, Hudson Taylor. So it was in the middle of the night once I was reading, when Hudson Taylor went to China, then he went back to the
England
to study to become a doctor so that he can reach out to the people. So, and you kind of vaguely think, you know, you just remember those moments that, I don't know, whether it's the spirit speaking or there's, you know, something that I thought, oh, I might consider that, you know. And then the second instance was my biology teacher. Like, I always wanted to be a professor of mathematics because I was really good in maths. But out of the blue, my biology teacher, who was a Christian girl, she said, oh, so, you know, if you should be thinking of doing medicine. I said, well, I've never thought of doing medicine, never in my life. But anyway, there was another instance, yeah. And then when we were students in Melbourne, we met Andrew Ng separately. So he came with a baby, and they were going out to Africa. We thought, oh my goodness, you know, they're so young.
Baby was in the bassinet.
Their elder son was in the bassinet, and there was that he influences like Kelvin, Christopher, all these leaders when he spoke to us. And it was one of the leadership training, you know, like, so it was Andrew Ng. He subsequently started up SIM East Asia, that's based in Singapore. That's probably why you heard about Singapore. Yeah. And it just consolidated my wanting to work in the cross-culturals. But I've always thought of going back to Malaysia to be a witness, as a Christian witness. And then the other place I thought is, can go to Southeast Asian country. I know the language. I can still eat Asian food. You know, I don't have to. And about Africa, never in my lifetime. So, but then we met, and so being missional, it doesn't matter which country you go to. And like, so my view of mission work has changed. Like, you know, you look at the last 60 years, you've got missionaries who are going into, well, pioneer missionaries, you know. But now if you look at the world, every country is developing. And so mission work is going to look different. And we talk about being professionals and to be able to empower them, to help them with education. And in that process, there's a lot of opportunities to share the gospel. And we are actually, we are like living the gospel of Jesus in our lives, in our profession, and demonstrating the love of Christ. And when we were working in Niger, this is a story I always like to tell, like Andrew learned how to do eye surgery. And so the people who are blind, they can see, they remove their cataracts, they could see. So that the elders, like the tribes from the desert, they came.
The Fulani tribe,
they come. We are hearing that people are
blind people are
seeing from your hospital. What are you guys doing? We want to know the miracle so we could do.
No, they want the
cure.
Black magic. Okay. They're into black magic.
And our Nigerian, our national pastors were able to share with them that this is the compassion of Jesus, that because of our love for Jesus, that's what we are doing. And some of them became Christians when they hear the story.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's the same like in Ethiopia. Like, in fact, Galmi Hospital is amazing. The testimony as a hospital. The hospital's been there 80 years now or more. And West Africa, they all know about Galmi Hospital. So people hear of miracles that's happened in the hospital. Yeah. So there's a saying called Sai Galmi, S-A-I, which is a Hausa.
Only
Galmi. So if you're sick, if you only go to Galmi. Even the American Peace Corps young people, they say if you're sick in Niger, don't go anywhere, just go to Galmi Hospital.
Mm. It's true.
And in Ethiopia, we unashamedly say that we are a Christian hospital and we minister in the name of Jesus. Anyway, missionary work, sorry, I just get a bit deep. It's going to be different. Like we instead of doing the work, we should be empowering the national
training
them, educating them, mentoring them so that they catch that vision, that they will be able to reach out to their own people. And it used to be in the past that some of the missionaries are very paternalistic, you know? And we still, some of them are still very paternalistic, but that's...
Can you speak a little bit about your last posting? So what is your area of specialty and what did you do the last posting that you had?
Last posting, well, so can start off. All right, so I am a general surgeon. So I basically became the program director for the Pan-African Academy of Christian Surgeons. And it's a 5-year training program. It's an apprenticeship like Australia. So you have an academic program, a spiritual program. So we have a spiritual curriculum and we go through a preset curriculum. We have weekly Bible studies. We pray every morning before we start. We have opportunity to witness and pray with our patients on the wards and clinics before surgery. So I basically ran the program for 5 years. Not only do we prepare them for the PACS exams. Now PACS is backed by Loma Linda University in America. It'll give you a diploma, but we also train them for COSEXA, which is the College of Surgeons of East Central and Southern Africa. So in Africa, there's basically three major surgical college: South African College, which is for South Africa; WACS, which is West African College of Surgeons for all of West Africa; and COSEXA is East Central Southern Africa. And they have 14 countries who belong to COSEXA, and they have one written exam and one viva for all the 14 countries. They have the British system, the MCSFCS. So in the 5 years, we had 9 of our people sit the exam, they all passed. So my work is program director, treasurer, planner, reporter, in charge of research, PR, etc., etc. So it was a very busy, very, very. And I don't think I've worked this hard in my whole life, but and came back quite exhausted. But it has been rewarding. We've seen lots of miracles. You see patients that you think will never survive that survive. And I guess I've been stretched in different ways. So you have to be a vascular surgeon, be a thoracic surgeon, you have to be cardiac surgeon, neurosurgery, maxillofacial, etc. So if you talk about what I did, like we'd do about 100 craniotomies a year, 50 maxillofacial reconstructs a year. There's a guy who was stabbed in the heart, had to fix him up, do some thoracic work. Then there, you know, thyroids and prostates and splenectomies and gastrectomies, call it, you name it. We did most of the things. I did even obstetrics. I don't do bones, I don't do orthopedics, but basically it was quite a big portfolio. Yep, so that was the 5 years.
Yeah, I actually signed up just to go to be his wife and to support him.
She's still my wife.
So I train as a general physician, but and my subspecialty here is palliative care, cancer support care. But I kept doing acute medicine because I know that we were going back to work in Africa, so I didn't want to lose my skills. When I arrived, I was just getting a broad view. I was just a bit nosy, not nosy. I was just walking around the hospital, just getting a view of how the whole hospital worked. And the medical director, a young man, brilliant, emergency specialist from America, in his 30s. He was there for 3 years. And he was basically trying to lift the standard of the hospital, and he was just burnt out. So anyway, I was kind of working with Jeremy a bit, and so together we ventilated the first patient. And then...
First patient, south of Addis, that was ventilated and survived.
Yeah, a young mother, twin... She would have died.
First patient ever ventilated in the hospital.
So they actually, Jeremy has actually bought a ventilator, but it was still in the plastic wrap.
Still wrapped up.
Then Jeremy, that was March, April. Then one day Jeremy turned to me, so I'm looking for a medical director to take over when I leave. I'm going home for 12 months. I said, Jeremy, don't look at me. I'm not. I said, I'm not interested.
Yeah, that was March he approached you. Mm.
5 years ago, March.
We've been in the country in. We came first of January.
2015. So this is March 2015.
He was asking me to help him see patients, and then. Then he was really burnt out. We were quite worried for him. Then one day I had a meeting with him and I said, okay, there's no one else. You have to, I said, well, Jeremy, I didn't come here to be the medical director. So anyway, you pray about it, yeah, pray about it. And I said, I'm not taking no for an answer. So 1st of April, I said yes to him. So I became the medical director. So I'm a system person, so we're running out of drugs, essential drugs, we run out of oxygen, we didn't have enough blood, the lab was running out of reagents, and we didn't have enough GPs, junior, the Ethiopian doctors to help us. So we only had 3 GPs, and they were very good GPs, and they were working really hard, but we couldn't attract any, because we are in the rural area.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the GPs would prefer to work in
capital cities,
or they work in government hospitals where they don't have to work really hard because they employ a lot of GPs, but they don't work hard. But they know that if they come to a hospital, our we work hard. So, and at that time, there were two or three new missionary families who also arrived about the same time, and there was a little bit, the dynamic was a little bit tricky and complex. But anyway, I said I'll take it up, and so I began working with the Ethiopians. So I mainly work with the Ethiopians, just trying to bring system up and working with the administration so that we have, so we need a constant supply of blood, of reagents, of drugs. We cannot, I mean, we are a hospital, we cannot run out of these essential things. So I work, I actually mentor my middle management, and then we had a cholera outbreak. And I called them, I said, look, I've never managed a cholera epidemic before. I said, don't worry, doctor, we know. So the older nurse, I said, we know, we've seen it. Okay, so you tell me what to do. So we all work together. And then we have a yellow fever outbreak. And we were the first people to notify WHO.
Yeah, you were the sentinel reporter.
Yeah. So, and WHO sent 1.5 million vaccines to us, you know, and we
contained the outbreak. Mm-hmm.
Contained the outbreak and all that.
That outbreak was 30 cases from us, right?
26. Yeah.
What year was this? When was this?
2019. Yeah, just before. It actually in the international. How do I mentor those middle? I talk about empowerment and empowering our national, because I told them, look, I want to work myself out of a job, basically. You know, if I walk away, the hospitals will still be working, and you as the in charge of the lab, you should know how to run the lab and how to order this and how to make sure that we don't run out of reagent and all that. So we put a system in place. I'm relational. I'm managed by walking around the hospital, and from not having any applicants for GPs, we have like, the year before we left, we had like 26 applicants for one position. So from 3 GPs, I was able to expand. I think we, in the end, we have like 11 GPs working for us. And so that with the GPs, we have teaching, we have case presentation, we have x-ray meetings, we have handover meeting every Monday to Friday. So the GPs become very motivated, very, very keen to be learning. And so out of them, in the 5 years, I sent for training radiologists, internal medicine specialists. We have an OBGYN in training, a pediatric in training.
Family medicine.
A family medicine and someone training in eye, ophthalmology. But I guess, and yes, I was recruiting the GPs to feed into the PECS training program. So all the GPs, most of our GPs have in training position.
Yeah. Not all of them, a few, a significant amount.
And then the GPs, one of them has gone to do psychiatry training, but this is like in government. So I would raise money to send them, to sponsor them.
Yeah. And then Ripka?
Oh, and then my assistant medical director, she is very smart. She wants to do internal medicine training, but she has gone to Sweden to do. She did a master's in public health.
Global health. Global health. Yeah. You have to be careful.
In fact, our church was very, very generous. Our mission, like King said, so I've got $5,000. Can you use it? I said, I can't use it, but I know someone who can use it. So that $5,000
went to tuition.
Well,
yeah. In Sweden.
Yeah.
And she got a distinction for her.
She wants to do a PhD. So that's
a lot of work. She will actually work harder than me.
And then we are a trauma hospital, so if there's any road accident.
She's in charge of ICU. Wow.
Oh, once then we send
year.
Yeah. We send our nurses.
She looks after the X-ray department.
So we send our nurses for
training.
For training intensive care nursing, you know. And so when we have our first ventilator patient, we all take turns because the nurses sleep.
I was the nurse looking after the ventilator at 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the morning.
But the last year that we like we have patients who are ventilated, we weren't called to see because they know how to manage. And this is together with a German ICU nurse. So we are a 142 bed hospital.
Yeah.
And then we started 6 ICU
beds.
So you have to talk. I know like running a hospital is very expensive and like all these equipments and manpowers and people that you have to send for training. Like how do you manage to like raise the funds for all this? Is it mainly from church or where?
I actually wanted to make the hospital self-sustaining financially. When I was medical director, we had a lot of missionaries who, so Michelle worked very hard. I worked together with Michelle to improve the pediatric and the neonatal intensive care. And so the missionaries, we don't get paid. So that is a big saving. The hospital is run by a foundation in America. And American Christians are very generous. They would donate. Yeah.
Mm.
So we have a poor fund. So patients who are poor, we would pay for their medical services. And a lot of the medications are donated.
Mm. Yeah. Equipment. But yeah. Equipment. So endoscopy.
Yeah.
So
we will raise funds.
You can only buy it through gifts. Yeah. Otherwise, it's not possible to. Capital works and all that, and equipment.
Yeah, equipment, buildings has to be raised.
Yeah.
The fund has to be raised because it's expensive.
Yeah.
So we had this friend, John Olsen, like he wrote to us, I'm a respiratory therapist, I use intensive care nurse, and I said, John, come, you know. And he brought us lots and lots of oxygen masks, ventilators, ventilating tubes, you know,
I think it was $70,000
$70,000 to $80,000 worth
of stuff he brought.
Consumables, yeah. But he gets them donated in America.
Ventilators. They're as big as this ventilator. Laptop ventilator.
Oh wow.
So Michelle, we have like in low resource facilities, like you need to be very innovative, like. So we actually are using, we have 3 proper ventilators, Dräger, the German make, but John was bringing us LCT, this is how big the ventilator is, and they are laptop ventilators.
For home use.
And these are for patients who are being ventilated at home, like the motor neuron disease where they can't breathe. So these ventilators are very easy to use once you get used to them. But the properly trained I'm not intensive care trained, but you have to update yourself, a huge learning curve. They will not use these ventilators.
Actually, for what we needed, this is more than adequate.
And then how do you choose who to, like here we did a refresher course in ICU when we came back for a short period of time. Like, I said, oh, I'm going to be ventilating a 90-year-old. I mean, it's difficult when you are resource poor, you have to make that sort of decision, you know, like. So if someone have cardiac and old, doesn't matter how much time you put them on the ventilator, they will not be able to come out of the ventilator to be what they
functional,
were before.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, I will not ventilate them. So I will be ventilating like young patients, they had acute lung injury, they need a bit of support, or they just have big operation in the abdomen and it's so too painful that they need they can't breathe properly, and so we support them. Or young overdose people that you know that you just get them, you can't do dialysis, right? So you get them through that period when their kidney washed out their drugs and then they can wake up. So in my hand, the patients are ventilated, they also.
And how about like surgical equipment? Because in like big city like Adelaide, city, there's a lot of resources, a lot of one-time use, disposable things.
So we have what we called reposable reusable disposables. We call them reposable. So you use them until they break and then you throw them away. So there's no such thing as single use.
And how do you adapt like to like with limited resources, like you don't have the technology that you have here? Like how does it work? Like performing the same surgery here compared to
You do it differently. So prostates, we do open prostatectomies, we don't do TURPs.
Yeah.
So for maxillofacial like fractures, we use dental wire rather than plates. And with very good results. So we use, when I, well, I've never done maxillofacial surgery. So the first, I don't know, 50 cases, we did pre and post-op CTs to look at how things were going. And then we did a follow-up on them and the results are functionally very good. So you can say that we're not giving them an inferior product, but you just have to adapt. I think at the end of the day, we cannot expect the same standards. So when I was doing cataracts in Niger, and I published the results in Australia, I got slammed. So I thought, this is terrible. Da da da. Why doesn't he give them reading vision? Da 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 da. So I said, well, because most of them are illiterate, so they don't need reading vision. All they need is to be able to navigate so that when they go to the toilet, you don't have a young boy leading them to the toilet, which is very degrading. And you free this boy up to do school and he can enjoy his kids. I mean, he might not be able to read because he doesn't read. He's got navigational stuff. So you have to look at what are you trying to achieve? You're not trying to achieve someone who's playing golf and they can't find the ball 500 meters away, right? So I think we have to be appropriate to the situation. And for us, for maxillofacial surgery, there's no, I don't think any other place is doing it. So if you don't do it, they are actually very, very badly off. Fractured jaws that don't unite, or when you have malocclusion, it's a terrible thing. Yeah.
I don't think we compromise standard that much, you know, in terms of like anesthesia.
It's like different.
You do it differently, but you don't compromise. Like we get all the essential drugs. So WHO has a list of essential drugs that we get the proper for. We can paralyze them properly. We can sedate them properly. We give them pain relief as much as we can. But there's probably like maybe the technology, for example, I mean, someone with complete heart block, you think that they should be able to have a pacemaker, right?
Yeah.
But we don't have that technology. Yeah. So I was trying to get Dennis to help us start up the, but that is like the cherry on the cake, you know, or the icing on the cake. And then what do we resort to? We resort to treating them medically and then asking them to do things that would minimize their symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, they come in with a heart attack, we can't give them a coronary bypass. We are in the poor area. So in Ethiopia, they don't have a cardiac service. They are beginning to have a cardiac service. And Dennis, do you know Dennis Lau? So one of our members in church, he's a cardiologist. He's the director of the rhythm in the Royal Adelaide Hospital. So now Dennis, because of COVID, but he will be going back to Ethiopia to help set up the cardiac center. He's interested in transferring that skill and helping them do that. Yeah.
So I think you have to look at the metrics. So if we look at anesthesia, anesthesia death is the ultimate, right? So you look at how many anesthesia deaths do we have? Not much more. Then we do audits. Wound infection rates, there's certain infections that are prone to infections. But generally, our wound infection rate is not high. If you look at trauma, if they get to a hospital, usually they survive. So we had a vena cava stabbing, so this guy got stabbed in the vena cava. You look at the figures, 50% do not make it to hospital. And those who make it to hospital, I think another maybe 50% don't make it out of the hospital. So we had a vena cava stabbing, he went home. Right, so if you look at those metrics, it's very hard to argue that we are inferior in that sense. And of course, you know, I believe that God has blessed us as well with the sort of resources that we have. But I think we have to take that in context. So we actually are, because of the program I'm running, it's an academic program. So we do audits. We do 2 weekly, we have morbidity, mortality, and we look through all our deaths, wound infections. So we have that quality control. But we are lucky because we have a CT scanner. So I think the CT scanner has helped us tremendously with head injuries. So people come in with a stroke, actually it was a chronic subdural, so you do a burr hole, they wake up and go home. You know, it's amazing. Acute traumas and so on. So we're backward where we're not backward, if you know what I mean. So we have a 16 slice CT. Now you talk about 256 slice here, we are 16 slice.
We're good enough, so we can do it.
So, you know, it's good enough for what we need. So that's that. You know, we don't need one to do cardiac surgery. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can basically help us with what is needed.
Mm-hmm. So like at the moment, like people with cancer, they're not able to get treatment readily.
Mm-hmm.
So only in the capital city, in the university hospital, even so, they are treated very poorly. So they are, things are starting to improve, but if you are rich, if you can afford, you go overseas. Like, but the poor people, and they present late because, you know, Ethiopia, 90% of them would live in the rural area and are peasants and farmers, and 10% are the elite.
Yeah.
So, Mekwa, you know, I spoke and presented about the mother who I need to deepen.
Yes.
I was just reading in one of our medical news. So 2 weeks ago in America, one of the big university hospitals, they have their own girl, a pediatric resident, just had a baby. She actually died from childbirth.
Oh, from eclampsia.
Eclampsia. Mm. So she had the best treatment. She had multiple team members to look after her. She died. I said, thank God, Lord, you were there with us.
Well, thank you very much for sharing all this with us.
Hope it's useful.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I think there'll be a lot of medical students and even medical professionals like Jun Chow will want to listen to this. Yeah. Any last words you want to share or anything else?
Yeah. I think, like, in as much as we give, we receive a lot. Like, you know, I think it's the people, it's the relationship in the end.
Amen.